I always say that this is my favorite night of the year, every year. It's the ultimate homecoming. The only way in which I wish that any of you were not here for 3 months was that if you could just enter this room this week after the 3 months and, you know, it's the ultimate enveloping, welcoming space. It's so great. I really always love to come and then to get to talk to the ultimate captive audience, as it were, is wonderful. Anyone who's ever spoken would wish that they were speaking to people who hadn't heard anything for 3 months. You can't go wrong. Words, how great. I looked around, I see a lot of familiar faces. I was wondering, this is a little grammar school-like, but I was wondering how many of you have been at these courses before. Amazing. Wow. I try to speak in a way that is universal and deep enough that addresses everyone. Congratulations. It's really, I always think as I'm driving over here, you know, that it's the timing of the 3 month course. I don't know quite how it happened at this time of year, but it's so great that it ends, you know, at the darkest time of the year, at the time when, you know, in every culture, always, there were always celebrations of light, and even now, you know, in all our spiritual traditions, there are celebrations of bringing the light out of the darkness. And I always feel that this is the most perfectly timed exit from the monastery for all of you to be, because whether you plan to or want to or intend to or not, you're going out shining like beacons into the world. And it always seems to me that that's a great gift. Everybody else is running around madly out there buying things. And you're just going to have to appear. It's great. I found this poem that I was thinking, if you had any thoughts, most of you have been through this transition before, but had you any thoughts that there are not other people like yourselves out there, I wanted to read you this poem by someone named Carlos Drummond de Andrade. He's Portuguese, died in 1987. But you'll recognize this poem. It's called In the Middle of the Road. In the middle of the road, there was a stone. There was a stone in the middle of the road. There was a stone in the middle of the road. There was a stone. Never should I forget this event in the life of my fatigued retinas. Never should I forget that in the middle of the road there was a stone. There was a stone. In the middle of the road, in the middle of the road, there was a stone. Isn't that great? I know you've all written this poem during these 3 months. I and most of us on the other side of the big wall have been, on the other hand, very busy during this time. And when I was looking around today, thinking about what to say, I found, I think in a piece by Brother David, he mentioned that the Chinese character for busyness comes from two sub-characters, for heart and for killing. So that's a caution. That's the big caution I bring. mostly I always like to say that practice doesn't stop. I mean, that's the whole message. Doesn't stop. There really is no wall. That there's a quality of sacred renewal that happens in here. But it keeps on going, and it just takes a different form now. But there are dangers that are different from the dangers that are in here. Busyness, of course, is the biggest one, and in our culture. It can kill the heart, and the heart is at the heart of everything that we want to carry forward. So, be careful. I wanted to start by asking you all what you're thinking, concerned about particularly about making the transition, either the very process of just walking into the next days or the whatever it seems like might be different for you out there than in here, and what you'd kind of like to hear about tonight. I have some thoughts, and but I'd kind of like to have them be more responsive to what you all are thinking. And when I asked Joseph and Sharon what you'd been thinking about and what you'd been sharing in the circles, they said that the biggest issue was why men wore shorts outside their pants. I didn't think I could deal with that. You know, as I said, partly I'm just here as a kind of person from the outside world to tell you that it's still there and it's okay. But, and Joseph said a little bit, in particular, I'll say this now so that you get a little hint of ways in which what I might be able to say that could be helpful. But for the last 10 years, I think of myself as an activist toward a more wholesome, sacred society. And so a person who's done a lot of work in the world and social change work, and that has also been trying to carry at the center of that the practice that you've all been doing. In the last 10 years, I worked mainly with Mayan people in Guatemala in communities in the mountains there who were recovering from the terrible violence and oppression that was going on there. And my partner in this work has been sitting here with you for the last couple of weeks. That's very nice. And then in the last year or so, I've been working on this new project, which is called the Project... I can't remember either. On contemplative mind in society. We're not fixed on this title, so if any of you have ideas, I'd like to hear them. But it's about looking at ways in which contemplative practice, including this practice and those contemplative practices from all the different spiritual traditions, ways in which they can have a beneficial effect in a whole range of areas of American life. So we're talking about and looking at things that are happening already, like the work that people are doing in psychotherapy or the work that Jonny Kabat-Zinn's been doing with pain management and stress reduction. We're looking at work that's being done in the schools and offering some fellowships for people to develop curriculum in the universities that would integrate practice or that would study the history of practice to try to bring it into more kind of legitimacy and awareness in American life. We're looking at ways to develop retreats that would be appropriate for different kinds of people. We did a retreat for business executives. We're doing one for environmental leaders. We're working on bringing... there's a conference on peacemaking and nonviolence that the Dalai Lama and Rigoberta Menchu are going to lead in San Francisco. So we're adding a piece of having a meditation practice by major meditation teachers be offered all during that, and then also bringing in youth. Dalai Lama asked to, I should call him His Holiness the Dalai Lama, working more closely with people who've worked closely with him. What they referred to him, I couldn't quite get over this. It was very efficient. HH the DL. That's what they call him. But that's what I mean about get ready for busyness. Bringing together youth whose lives have been affected by violence, which means largely inner city, urban youth, together with the Dalai Lama and Rigoberta Menchu, and with other teachers of martial arts and other contemplative practice and ritual, to look at, to bring forward nonviolent responses to conflict in a way that has credibility for youth. So those are the kinds of things I've been involved in recently. It's been really wonderful for me to bring, you know, the heart of what we've all been doing specifically into action in the world. So I'd like to hear what areas of that we might talk about tonight that are most present for you, any of you. It'll help.
I'm kind of curious to hear about the plan for not only working with these groups, but what if there is a plan to set up a perpetuating thing where it continues into the next generation so that these systems that are starting their skillful programs can continue and that young people like myself can participate or get involved or, you know, work in a similar way.
Great. I will, and also I wanted to say that by saying what I was doing, I didn't mean specifically that I wanted to know what you wanted to know about that, although I'm happy to answer it, but what's on your minds in general about yourselves. And if I don't say things like this in illustration of something, then I'd be happy to answer any specific questions later. Okay. Yeah?
Bringing into social change work with sort of contemplative approach, not only in terms of interfaith, but also bringing it to a larger secular society without proselytizing or without the issue. One of the issues for me is that, for example, John Kabat-Zinn's work, that on one hand, he's making accessible a lot of the skillful means that were taught by the Buddha, but also there's a much broader source of wisdom that is difficult to bring to people without feeling like you are trying to convert them to be Buddhists. So I'm just sort of interested in what your experience.
Yeah.
I've worked in not a sheltered workshop, a lot of business travel, a lot of meetings, and I very much like the environment and the people. And so, and I also very much love this practice. So I would like suggestions about being wholehearted about doing the kind of business work at the same time, not getting sucked into the point of getting unbalanced for the practice.
Yes.
Before I came here, I was involved, if I can remember back that far, in a lot of discussions with people around the right livelihood. And an issue for me that also seemed to be fairly general among the people I was talking with was organizations that were full of people who, like me, wanted to do their work from the heart. And the organizational structure and the organizational values seemed opposed to that. So it wasn't one person within the organization, it was many people within the organization, but not knowing how to deal with that difference between their values and the organization's.
Yep. Yep. Yes.
There's something that has come up that was very nicely put last night. And that is that after two sentences, you've lost awareness in conversation. I really find that absorbing observation if we the bright and beautiful journey out of here, two sentences later, are completely oblivious to the body. And just talking, how can we know this possibly? Create these wonderful projects.
With regard to social change work or political, economic, yada yada, change work, it seems like in the past my motivation and that of many other people that I have worked with has been either a kind of a burning thirst for justice or a great anger at the conditions that exist. And as I've moved more, not completely, but more towards equanimity, that momentum dissipates. And while I think the danger of burnout from that powerful desire or need to change things is not going to happen, there's also less, more of a sitting back and less motivation to continue. Can you speak to that?
I can.
It's kind of hard to put into words, but one of the major impacts that came from outer world during this retreat for me, during these 3 months, was a letter from my girlfriend, and we live now in the former eastern part of Berlin, I'm German. And she said that one night she got waking up to shouts out on the street. And there was a gang of young neo-Nazis screaming, Sieg Heil, you know, the Hitler shouting. And as you all know, that the neo-Nazis is, the movement is, it's not history, it's a present factor in many countries, and in Germany, of course, as well. And becoming more aware through this practice of, on the one side, of our interconnectedness and selflessness, and a great compassion for all beings, including them. And on the other hand, really feeling like a call to take some kind of stand. you have any experience of dealing with like criminal groups or
I do. Yeah. Yes.
Oh my God, but what haven't you done? It's a trip.
A few things.
I have a similar concern to Vera's, who just spoke in front there, because I was a community organizer working in public housing tenants, and I still have some very dear friends who are in that field, and I have basically given up a career from being able to pursue my formal practice. I'm curious as to your experience with particularly with people who have been involved in social change for their entire lives, who don't consider themselves spiritual, but who have embodied the qualities of kindness and compassion in the work that they do. One of my mentors in this field once described his motivation as twofold. He said it's a combination of love and rage that makes him do what he does on behalf of poor people to seek justice. So my concern is just how to do it. And I want to see more people who are doing that kind of work get more involved with formal practice. I know there's a center in the midst of I see that there's more attention to that. What's it under your own experience?
No, I just, I feel dyslexic or something. We did, the women did used to be on the side, didn't they? Isn't it? It's so strange, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, just checking. Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to know how to work with fatigue. I work with a lot of people and a lot of beautiful staff, and we have to work with developmentally disabled. And we really love them and we want to do more for them, but we're really tired and we just really get exhausted.
Couple more. Even, you know, anything is okay, and if you just have a fragment, even if it's just emerging and it's not a theory or a well-defined question, it'd be fine. Yeah?
I would just like to know whether you have suggestions on how to be in this world, in this business world, and in all these things you do, and simultaneously keeping the sacred space where you can where you aren't being lost in the thing. So being with the things but not being lost in the things.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I was sitting around in Sharon's room before saying, I don't know what I'm going to talk about tonight. But I see that there's no shortage of of things to talk about. Also, before I start, I wanted to just say that it's really not about questions and answers, because you know by now that, you know, you're the only one who knows the answers, the real answers. And I will, you know, kind of talk around some of these things and share with you some of what I've heard and seen, but I really want to undercut the notion of questions and answers and the one who knows and then the one who asks the questions, you know. Just get straight on that. Well, I guess all these comments are really, they were very helpful, and they really all address what I find when I leave retreat is the biggest difference. It's like, well, here, when you're all in this room together for all this time, it's like in the 60s we looked up the definition of the word conspiracy. It was a big word then. And what it means, of course, is breathing together. And you all are in a kind of conspiracy here. And when you go back to your families and communities, you'll be in a slightly different kind of environment. And one of the biggest things that happens, whether you kind of realize it when you're in here or not, and so many of you have, you know, done this long retreat before, but it's very, even with all of our neuroses and all of our negativities and all of our closings down, that the practice, all of it, especially the metta practice, of course, but all of it is very opening of the heart. I mean, it creates a kind of vulnerability in us, a healthy vulnerability of openness to other beings from the glimpses we have of being interconnected with all other beings, and just simply being in a protected place like this, able to reflect on what's important for all this time, we become very open. And when you go back into a world where that's not true for everybody, you're more aware than usual of the suffering that exists in the world. It's also true, we know that the heart of the practice is that by seeing your own suffering, you then have empathy and compassion for the suffering of other beings. And then that arises as, you know, that calls you in a way that it may maybe more powerfully than it did before. It's really, I think we all know the experience of that seeing, being open enough to see the suffering in other beings, and having the response, that compassionate trembling arise, like it's an in-breath and out-breath, you know. I think of being in here as a kind of in-breath, you know, and that we're really going in deeply, and now we're going out, and that in the ways that they are so, you know, perfectly a whole, that once we go out of the monastery, that our response and interconnection with the people who we're with out there really comes to life. And over this year especially, I've really been thinking about the connection between meditation or contemplation and action, and how really they are they're not parts, but they're two aspects of a whole, and that one really can't exist without the other. That when we go deep inside, the deeper you go, the more you see that interconnection that draws you then out. And we're drawn to do some kind of healing, you know, that healing coming out of the heart, that the real, I mean, I think that interconnection that you glimpse maybe most powerfully in the metta meditation, but you know, we've all had these moments of seeing how it is all one. That's the vision, and that the vision has as its natural other aspect action. And if you have action without vision, you have what might be called mere activism, you know, which we've all kind of seen people who are busy running around trying to make change, trying to do things, but without the vision that of interconnection, of the sacredness of all living beings. Without that, without working from the really deep place, then it's merely activism. But without action, vision itself is incomplete. So we're now about to like take that step where it's not that you're not acting when you're here, but of course it's quieted down, and you're about to take that step of completion and to find the ways in which the cultivated vision finds its other side. You can also, I've been thinking about it also like as the vision part or what you see through the inside practice as seeing, you get in touch with meaning, what it's all about. And then the action part, or the more worldly part, has to do with purpose. And if you have purpose without meaning, which is seems to be what so much of the world is about these days, people really lost touch with the meaning. It's not that the meaning's still not there, but people have forgotten, and so they have this kind of purposeness, is that a word? But they've forgotten the meaning, so they're just kind of like going forward and doing things, and that then becomes a kind of drudgery, you know. So here we have like this deep privilege, which is all of our birthright, but we know that it's so rare to discover vision and to discover meaning, and now we're going to integrate the other part of it with it. It's really precious time, I think. Probably the most important action to bring is the one that you've all been doing nonstop, which is listening. I mean, we could think of this whole practice as a form of listening, of inner listening, that once this kind of awareness gets cultivated, that being in the world is not so much like a fixing kind of action, but it's really a responsive action. It's a really listening to the world and responding to it, like really tuning to the moment and everything that's going on, and then finding the most skillful means for responding to the action. And I mean, nobody mentioned sort of trying to discover new livelihood, but you know, livelihood, relationships, you know, where and how you should live, how you should build community. These are all the kinds of things that we have to do in the world. And they, when they're conscious and when they're awakened, they are part of a function of responsiveness to the world rather than, a kind of mindless action. One of the things that I was involved in this year was this retreat for corporate executives. I didn't want to do this. I got asked to do it, and I didn't want to do it. It was with a corporation that was a chemical corporation, very toxic history. For the last 10 years, I had worked in sustainable agriculture in Guatemala, and with Mayan people who have earth-based spirituality and who were so broken by what had happened not only to their families but also to their land and the separation they felt from their land. And a lot of that had happened because of chemical fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides and fungicides and all of that goes with the chemical abuse of the land. So this corporation was one of the main corporations responsible for this very destruction. And needless to say, I had cast them as the bad guys, if there ever were any, between them and the Guatemalan military. It was it was hard to make a hierarchy, but anyhow, I agreed to do it with other people, with Steve Smith, who teaches here, and some others, and we did this, and it was so instructive. And a lot of it was about listening. We decided that when they came, that it would be a little too much to get them to just sit down and start watching their breath immediately. They flew in on their corporate jets. They had their power books all in their hands. You know, they had worked a half a day on Friday. It was a weekend because they didn't want to miss any time. And then they came. And so we decided to do a few kind of warm-up exercises. So we did a deep yoga relaxation. And then we asked them to go out into the... It was great. It was a retreat place in Kalamazoo, which was kind of homey for them. They're like the Midwestern executives like that. So there are woods around it, but I mean, I think of it as kind of landscaped. But they thought of it as wilderness. So the idea was that they would go out into the woods and they'd find their spot, you know, that was kind of, and they'd sit out there for 45 minutes, and we'd made them these little books out of that recycled paper that has like lots of twigs and flowers and things in it, so they couldn't mistake it for a legal pad, you know. And they were to take their notebooks and find their spot, and then just listen and look, and only pay attention to those two senses. The idea was to sort of start letting things fall away, you know. And it was amazing. It was amazing what happened. If any of you can remember back to the first hour you sat, you know, but I was so touched by the power of letting go some of the senses, to begin to close down some of those sense doors, and to just, we didn't even give very deep instruction. We just said, go out and look and listen and write in your books anything that you see or hear. And it was 45 minutes. It wasn't long. And they came back in and they were just absolutely stunned by it. It was as if they had gone on a vision quest. And, you know, they came back and they had really started to hear. And it was great. Some people said, I said, well, how do you like the notebooks? Some people said, well, I didn't really like it because when I tried to write down what I heard, I realized that the word wasn't the sound. We said, okay, you can go home now. So it was kind of about, you know, it's not so far away that, you know, that we really, we can shift our listening. And I mean, you've all been doing it for 3 months, but or 6 weeks or whatever. It's so powerful. I mean, they, you know, people said they had just not heard anything like, you know, any sounds of nature, you know, in years. People started telling stories about when they were 8 and 12 And you realize that was the last time they'd had an experience like that. That when we really try to listen, we hear something really different. There was, later in that retreat, there was the head, these were the, it was 15 people, they were the top executives in a 30,000 employee company. And so this guy was the head of a very controversial product. And you can see I haven't totally given up judgment. But I ended up really loving these people. And so he said, this touched me, is so innocent and so beautiful. He said, you know, he said, people come to my office and I wasn't quite sure who, I don't think activists get into this corporation, but I think it would be more like press or, I'm not sure. And he said, they come into my office and he said, you know, it's been very controversial. And he said, come in, and they're saying things to me about this product. And he said, my head's so full that I can't hear anything they're saying. My head is so full of what I'm supposed to say to them as soon as they stop talking. That, and you know, you've seen that look on the faces on TV or wherever, you know, of people who are in that kind of position. That I don't hear anything they say, but I'm beginning to know that I should be listening to them. So then he said, do you think this practice could help me listen better? probably. Here's the last listening one from that retreat was, this is great. I don't know if you did, you probably did eating meditations. Well, you do it at every meal, I guess, here. So I've been away. Okay, so we did one meal specifically where we took people through eating, tasting, texture, smell, and so on. And we were at a place that didn't have very good food. It had kind of Midwest American kind of white bready kind of cuisine. And and the vegetables were frozen, you know, and you know, it was kind of like that. So I was eating this potato salad, and I was really trying, and you know, and I was like, I was kind of trained in this meditation on like really like organic brown rice, you know, where like you, after you eat it, you swear you're never going to eat anything ever again except organic brown rice and, you know, homegrown vegetables. So I was eating this potato salad. There was like kind of a lot of mayonnaise, and the potatoes, I kept like trying to taste them and more awareness. And it was like there was nothing, there was nobody home, you know, there was nothing in this potato. So I was thinking, oh gosh, you know, I was being responsible, you know, I said, oh, they're not going to be able to, you know, this isn't going to work. So they're not going to get it. So after, when we talked, when it was all over, and one woman said, how is the eating meditation? She said, My peas were so noisy. I said, what? She said, and this was, again, like the power of the practice. It was so amazing. She said, that will reveal whatever's there. She said, my peas were so noisy. I could hear the machines that picked those peas. And I could hear the machines that shelled the peas, and I could hear the freezer that they'd been frozen in, and I could, then she went on to say she could taste this and that, and I thought, I mean, she really could hear it, and I thought, amazing. I had realized that I'd thought, oh, only with like, this only works, you know, with really good food. You know, it's like, this is a day and a half of practice. She could hear those machines. And you figure if people who are, and she heard that that was not a kind, you know, way to treat these peas, that was in her voice. There are lots of questions about, someone brought up about, you know, whether if people inside big institutions change, whether the institutions, in fact, will change. That's a big question. But it was pretty remarkable to see people who, you know, they hadn't signed up for the three-month course. They really came because their CEO encouraged them to come. And the kind of shift in, for instance, listening in a day and a half of sitting quietly was really amazing. So I know that when you take your listening out, it changes the whole way of being. I was in France this fall, and I was in Orléans, where Joan of Arc was from. When I was growing up, I always loved Joan of Arc. You know, there weren't too many women models then, in those days. And I always liked Joan of Arc. And but I really didn't really know that much about her. But I don't know if you do, but she was 19 years old. I mean, this is history. She was 19 years old, and she heard God speaking to her. She heard this voice telling her to save France. It's great. You know, that I always hear that old Mel Brooks routine, you know. He says to her, someone says, it's a 2,000-year-old man. They say, so you've been around a really long time. You must have known Joan of Arc. He says, know her, I vent with her. Then he says, so what did you do when she was... He said, I said, you say France, I'll clean up. But anyhow, the real Joan of Arc, she got the word to save France. It was pretty remarkable. And she went off on, you know, she went to the king, and she had this idea about, like, how to lead the army, and I don't even remember exactly what was happening. It was the English, I remember that. And she did. And I just, I thought, and she's all over France, and I thought, well, especially, of course, for young girls, but for everybody, the idea that this person who had, you know, nothing to do with the institutions, heard from within herself what it was she was supposed to be doing. I mean, that's how we can translate it for us. She listened, and she heard, this is your dharma. This is what you're supposed to be doing right now. And because she went to the king and said, I'm going to save France, and he gave her a horse and an army, and she did it. it really is, I mean, that's what we are doing right here, you know, listening for what it is we're supposed to do. And you know, without being too, you know, New Age or whatever it is, you know, that the truth is that the way does open when you really hear what it is that you are supposed to be doing. And so whether you have, and it's moment to moment, for very few of us do we get, you know, marching orders like that, as it were. And she was killed, hung, I guess, very soon after she did that. So she didn't have like that kind of like after your time of glory period to deal with. But it's you know, it's really more moment to moment. But that's what the practice is in the world. It's really listening and acting on what you hear. I'll read you a poem, and then I'll address some of these, more of these things that you brought up. This is a poem from a poet named Francisco Alarcón. He wrote to his students, to the students of the Yo Puedo program, 1989, and their families. Let us carry our roots with us all the time. Let us roll them up and use them as our pillow. Let us be the dream of our elders, the promise of their ribs, the answer to their prayers. Let us fill up all gaps, tear down all barriers. Let us find godliness in every face, every tree. May our ears hear what nobody wants to hear. May our eyes see what everyone wants to hide. May our mouths speak up the truth of our hearts. May our arms be branches that give shade to the needy. Let us be a drizzle, the salt of the earth, the horizon that unites the beginning and the end. Let us accept ourselves the way we are. Let us take presents in and give them back manifold. Let us see ourselves 20 years from now. These are students. Who is now the doctor, the nurse who can heal? Who is now the teacher who can really teach and learn from students? The social worker who cares, the lawyer who defends the poor, who defends the poor, the innocent, the organizer who makes dreams come true? Who is now the mother who takes a child to school, the lover that can forgive and love again? Let us keep forever the child within each of us. May our shoulders grow wings so we can be butterflies. Let us be the key that opens new doors to our people. Let tomorrow be today. Yesterday has never left. Let us all right now take the first step. Let us finally arrive at our promised land. I think it's so great when you hear, you know, the Dharma, you've been listening to it in its Buddhist form, and you hear it in all these other forms, and it's the same, and you know that it's the truth. I think about right livelihood, that really the most important thing is what came up in another comment, which is this: the attempt to align your personal values with the values of whatever institution you're working with, or whatever you know, profession or area that you're working in. That's, it seems to be like the biggest form of grief and alienation and that people experience, is this feeling that they're not, that their work doesn't reflect what they know to be true and what matters to them. And you know, from doing this practice so much, I mean, the good news is that you're really in touch with what, with meaning, with what matters, with what's true. The hard thing is that very often in life, you're not in a, in the perfect environment to act that out. So the work around right livelihood is working with that tension and trying to see the ways in which you can bring your truth more into the environment that you're in. Sometimes that requires shifting what you're doing. You know, the basic guideline is not to harm. It's like the doctor's oath, you know. But when you really start penetrating and looking into non-harming, it's big. I mean, it's really every aspect of what you do needs to be examined. You know, and so it's a tension between doing that and continuing to do that, and at the same time, you know, recognizing the, you know, imperfection of the institutions we find ourselves part of. It's very hard for us right now in this country. And because then, you know, there are some alternatives are working by yourself, but a big part of what we need to be doing is building community at work and not at work, working with other people, helping to change the institutions, looking at, you know, what can be changed. They're pretty inhuman right now. They're pretty adharmic. They're not places where... Michael Lerner of Tikkun, who is trying to start this movement around meaning and values and politics, talked about why don't we have as one of our goals in American life that everyone is entitled to spiritual space in their lives. You know, if you think about like kind of reworking what it's all based on, it would look very different if we really tried to create institutions that were based on true Shila, were based on truth. I was having a talk yesterday with Mitch Kapoor, who's a friend of some of ours. He was the founder of Lotus Systems, Lotus 1-2-3, you know, so he was a guy who liked to work on software, you know, in the garage, kind of. He was good at it, and he kind of fell into business because he was doing it right at the time when all of that turned into business. And so it, the same thing happened to, at a much smaller scale, to me and my husband, was my former partner. We were trying to sort of distribute these mandalas to show the unity of all paths, you know. But the only way you could do it in American culture was to sell them, you know. So, you know, we did "May all beings be happy," and, you know, it was, they were called Dharma seals. And it was great. They were sold in alternative bookstores, and they said all over them, you know, this represents like the truth of the deepest truth of all traditions and so on. And people used to steal them from bookstores. The bookstore owners started asking us to put them in packaging like CDs or something, so that because people would slip them into their books as they left the stores. Anyhow, it's partly because we have such little respect for the institutions, you know, even. And Mitch was saying that we were talking about how in business there's no commitment to telling the truth. I mean, like most of us in our personal lives feel like you ought to tell the truth, and sometimes you don't. I mean, I try to always tell the truth, but I mean, I think people in general, they still like accept that as a value, that you should tell the truth. But in business, that's not true. And it's so shocking when you get in there and see that it's because it's like Alice in Wonderland, you know, it's like a whole different set of rules are going on. So it's to say that our institutions really aren't based on dharmic principles, and they need to shift. And so I would say around right livelihood, don't get too discouraged if you find yourself in a less than perfect environment, and that we all need to bring to it what we can, because I don't know if they can change, but if they can change, they will only change from the people who are inside them. The matter of burnout, that applies equally to being in institutions in livelihood as well as specific activism. But the best response to burnout is continuing a good practice, because it's returning to the heart. Someone talked about anger. Activism and social change particularly attracts, particularly has to deal with this issue. Environmentalism, same, which is part of activism, but around people feel that if they give up their anger, that they will no longer be motivated to make change, and they'll just kind of sit around eating chocolate, But it turns out that, at a superficial level, I think that's true. Like, if you give up anger without awareness, that might be true. Then you'd be in apathy. People think this is like either rage or apathy. But in fact, as you may have glimpsed, there are other states. And the true motivation, it comes from something much deeper than anger. It comes from an awareness of interconnection, an awareness of the rightness of connection of all things. It comes from a deep sense of justice that comes from glimpsing compassion and care for other beings. It comes from the sense of sufficiency that comes from deep awareness, of knowing just how much is enough, which is clearly, related to the distribution of resources and different aspects of justice. So the answer is, we used to laugh years ago, Sharon and I did our first meditation course together. Shared a little space. We lay next to each other. We had saris for walls. It was in a big open space like this, and then the beds were divided. There were mats on the floor. They were divided by saris hanging up. It was in India. And our teacher was Goenka. And no matter what, the practice was called sweeping. You brought your awareness through your body. And no matter what question you asked him, it could be anything, he always said, "Keep on sweeping." So it was a great answer, because then after you left, you always knew the answer to anything that arose. But it's the same answer to burnout and the burnout and the whole issue of rage as a motivation, is that it's always to go back in and look deeper, because if you get behind, as I'm sure you've done a lot of, you must all have had experiences of anger and other negative emotions during this time. If you start dissolving it, then you get deeper, and you get to the place that that really sustained work for change can come out of. We've been doing a series of retreats for different kinds of activists, and they've been, because someone mentioned that you did, that many activists there's a whole world of faith-based activists coming out of the various spiritual traditions, but there are a lot of people who came out of a more, either Marxist or just a secular motivation for change. And but it's been very interesting that, in general, people in the culture at large are just so burned out and so discouraged that with the way things have gone, that there's a tremendous opening and yearning for new ways to be with things. I mean, for some people wouldn't express it spiritually, but they would say that they really want to see things in a new way, and they would like to try to approach things in a new way. So we've been involved in for the last 7 years or so in retreats, and Vallecitos is a part of that for activists and others that have been really extraordinary. People really remembering, it's really what it's about, remembering why we do what we do. And it's been very powerful, very sustaining for people. I think around one important message about the idea about if we can lose our awareness so quickly in a couple of breaths, you know, what hope is there? You know, it's not to worry. That you can't lose it because it's not a something, and it's the truth. And once you've glimpsed it, you know, you're always going to want to get back there. And of course, you know, and of course you lose concentration. And when you're distracted by many more things than you are here, you're going to probably lose it more easily. Maybe not. It's different for everybody. But you just, it's just keep on sweeping, you know. It's like you just go back and do more of it, you know. And you... It really is not to worry. All the scriptures say it, but also everyone knows who's practiced that it something when you open up to and glimpse the preciousness of the Dharma, you're always going to want to go back, you know, and. You know, there are lots of times are harder than other times. It's just the way of it. And then you just keep on practicing, you know. And I think that's the only answer, you know. You don't really have to worry about it. It's bigger than we are. About dealing with adversaries, and this is a major issue in activism in general, but, you know, dealing with neo-Nazis or, you know, we for years had to deal with the Guatemalan military who were really brutal. And so, I mean, these were people who'd killed many people we loved and continued to. And it was a real, you know, still, of course, you know, these things, you don't, like, do them and they're over. But the process of trying to keep your heart open to people who've done evil things, you're not, you know, it doesn't mean that you are approving or supporting their evil actions. But it's a process of trying to, you've all been working on it through the metta practice, but to recognize that all beings are interconnected and that we're all part of each other. And until all beings are awakened and enlightened and loved and home, that none of us will be. It doesn't mean that you don't do everything you can to change what they're doing. It's that same dilemma about accepting things exactly as they are and in the same time doing everything you can to change them. I mean, when you perceive that it could move in a more wholesome direction. It's puzzling at first, you know. Because by accepting things as they are, you know, I mean, the work is you do it inside yourself, with yourself, and then you can, from that you can take it outward. But that whole fear that if we accept ourselves just as we are, maybe then what? I mean, we might not get better, or, you know, we might be approving of something that we something in ourselves that we would like to see change. But that's not what it's about. You know, it's just as you see in the practice, like the moment exists. The moment is that, you know, it's that confluence of all this karma from the whole past comes and creates the moment. And then you bring your wisdom to it and you see ways in which you can respond to it. And I think it's the same with, you know, with... It's related to this issue of people who are really doing bad things, you know, that that by loving them as beings doesn't mean that we approve of what they're doing. And it's probably the only way that we're ever going to reach them and help the change. You know, in Aikido is a Zen or form of martial arts, and in it there's no attack. I mean, there's a ritualized attack, but there's no attack to harm another person. The idea is that in Aikido you learn to put the other person down so that you can keep him from harming. You protect yourself, but you're also protecting him from harming you. So you're protecting him from creating bad karma, because your responsibility is as great to him as it is to yourself. And the essential move in Aikido is called blending. And instead of moving away from your enemy as he attacks you, you move in. You move in so close to him that you can feel exactly how he's going to move, and then you know how to move to throw him. So there's something about this dealing with people we perceive as so different from ourselves that requires that kind of compassionate movement. Does that make any sense to you? It's a little theoretical in here, but it's true. Someone asked about fatigue, and you know, the whole matter of sustainability is, you know, in the presence of hard things is big. And that's why, I mean, we need to do all that we know how to do, you know. We need to renew ourselves. That's why compassion meditation starts with compassion for yourself and taking care of yourself. And doing all the things that we know to make it a more sustainable world will help sustain those of us who are working in it, you know. So, I mean, we've been looking at ways to bring practice into workspaces and in everyday life, you know, where, you know, it depends on what your scene is, but, you know, whether you can find a way to be quiet together a little bit, find a way to create some kind of sacred space in the middle of all the busyness. You know, do all the things that you know to sustain yourself, and then there's a different set of things you can do to help sustain community. But it's the central work right now, because everybody, you know, it's very hard right now. So it's not to be discouraged when it happens, but to do what you know to do and to help support the people you're doing it with, because that's Sangha, that's the second part, you know. That spiritual, it's all spiritual work, and it can't be done without all three aspects, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Here's one more poem I think you'll like. To pray, this is a poem called Eagle Poem by a Native American poet, Joy Harjo. To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you. And know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know, except in moments steadily growing and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Like eagle that Saturday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky, in wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, see ourselves, and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this, and breathe, knowing we are truly blessed because we were born and die soon within a true circle of motion, like eagle rounding out the morning inside us. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. You know, maybe we could sit for a little while, and then everyone who wants to can leave, and if anybody else wants to stay and talk a little, comment, question, anything, we could do that. How does that sound?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.